Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. Or you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm really delighted to have Elena Maria Viramontes. Her new novel is Their Dogs Came With Them. It's published by Atria Books. She's the author as well of Under the Feet of Jesus and a collection of stories called The Moths. And this is one of those rare occasions where I read a book. I felt that I knew this writer very well. We'd spoken before on Bookworm. And along came a book 12 years after her last one that really is what is in the purest form a breakthrough book. Nowadays, they talk about a breakthrough book, and what they mean is it's a bestseller. But when the term was invented, it referred to a writer who really had broken through to a new level of treating her material and her themes and found a level of expressiveness and structure that brought her work to a culmination. And that's what we have in Their Dogs Came With Them. It's the result of 12 years of work, and as I understand it, it began even before Under the Feet of Jesus.
Yes, yes, yes. Michael, first of all, thank you very much for having me. Yes, and in fact, it was my first novel. I would say I began writing it. I believe in about 1990, and at that time, I was with two very young children, and I made a pact with my husband. I said, give me some space and so I can finish this draft, at least the second draft, which I did. I went to Puerto Rico and I spent a month with filmmaker Ana Maria Garcia, locked myself in a room and wrote the second draft. When I returned, I was so exhausted from that experience because I was writing sometimes 7-8 hours a day. I mean, for me, time was so precious at that time because the kids were small. I was doing community work. I was working part-time. I just thought, I really this is like now or never, which is what I did. And I returned home, and in this exhausted period, I began reading, which is what I do. I write and read and write and read and write and read. And I was reading Erlinda Gonzalez's Berry, Palatitas de Guayaba, and in her memoir, she wrote about her father prohibiting her from her and her sisters going into the barn. That immediately struck my heart's core, and I put the memoir down, and there was a piece of paper in front of me, and I began sketching a barn and a young girl. Why did that young girl want to go into the barn, and why did males want to keep her from that? And I thought, well, this could be a beginning of a short story. Well, lo and behold, it was the beginning of Under the Feet of Jesus, which then took my imagination for the next 2.5 years.
And it was written then again and again over the years, yes?
This the dog's book?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Depending, I mean, I must have written I don't know how many drafts because it was so difficult to write and because of all the, I mean, the 90s was such an incredibly weird time. I mean, we had the first Iraqi war, and we had that language, and we had, and so, you know, I was very much interested in the type of language that the Iraqi war was being sold to the U.S. Then that aspect, you know, that aspect ended, and then I continued on, and then lo and behold, the Iraqi war in 2001. Came about, and again the same thing. So, you know, during this whole time, because of the 90s and the decades of fear and binary language and all this other things going on, this is what influenced me continuously as I wrote this novel out, never truly understanding or knowing what it was going to become. I mean, I really didn't. I instinctually just had to trust my imagination that it was going to take me somewhere, because it was taking me. But I had no idea where, And I have to say, you know, into about 4 years of it, I was petrified because I had, I mean, here I was a creative writing teacher, and all the questions that I asked my students, like, you know, who are the characters? What's at stake? What are the motivations of the character? I had no idea. It was this really just this project of great darkness that I had to sort of like touch around with my fingers and just try to find shapes so that I could find doors to open them, and eventually just being very trustful of my imagination, there rose a structure, and that was the Freeways.
Well, it is to me astonishing because this book, which takes place between 1960 and 1970 in a particular area of East Los Angeles, is a city novel. It's a portrait of a community.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurs written in the styles of that era, but also of the things, in a sense, that happen in literature afterwards. A certain amount of magical realism, a certain amount of minimalism, but in particular, it uses the place to penetrate into the souls of its characters, and the revelations grow deeper and deeper and deeper, and the connection between the characters grows more and more surprising.
Mm.
And you come to understand that this book could not have been written without not just knowing these characters, but having written about them for years, that the spaces where the people meet and intersect are the result of a very deep-seated, you couldn't do this on a chart. You know, you couldn't map out the structure of the book. And it is so full of surprises. The book's jacket doesn't even begin to prepare you because it tells you that it's the story of four Latina girls.
Yeah.
But it goes into the heart of the butcher,
yeah,
the heart of an unstable boy in the community, and what you think is a digression, when you first hear it, becomes central the next. Tell me, how was this accomplished? Because in addition, each chapter, I'm sorry to be raving, but I really love the book. Each chapter begins in 1960, but then you move through 10 years. Sometimes you start at 70 and go to 60. Sometimes you start in 60 and go to 70, and you're watching the evolution of a neighborhood and the characters within that neighborhood.
Well, you know, you're right. I think this is my, you know, this little corner of the world is so fascinating to me. And I'm even, my other novel titled The Cemetery Boys, my work in progress, deals with the same corner because here is a corner, I have to say, that a half mile down, my mother was born and raised. And a half mile from that house to the house that we were all raised in is where she died 78 years later. That half mile for me has the most incredible history, a lot of it personal history. And it's just, you know, it's just right across from the Chinese cemetery, which is across from the Serbian cemetery, which is adjacent to the Calvary cemetery, which is across from Ophalos, a Jewish cemetery. Not more than maybe a mile down, we have the First Street Evergreen Cemetery, which is the oldest cemetery in the novel. I mean, the oldest cemetery in the city. So you have all these cemeteries. Then you have these freeways. As a child, I remember there being no freeways, and then I remember where all, you know, the going through these empty houses, not really understanding what was going on, and then the grazing of all this, of all of these houses, and then the bulldozers coming and digging and digging and digging so that you can see the roots of the trees. That's how far they dug to make room for the 710 freeway. And I think about all that, and I think about, and this is a story that I tell. I think about during the time that they were doing that, there were several people that had told us that, you know, during the construction, during the time, this is an urban legend. It's never been proven, but this is what we were told, is that during the construction, people did find bones, and that they just tossed them because they had to continue with the building of the freeways. And now when I look from the porch, and this is what I firmly see, when I look from the porch of my mother's house and I see the interchanges, there's four or five of them up right across from us. When I see the interchanges of the freeway, I not only see the freeways upheld by cement and steel, but also by the bones of the forgotten. And this is what I wanted to do. This was my main commitment. What happened to this neighborhood? What happened to all the people? This is what I wanted to do. I wanted to be able to recreate them so that I would understand somehow, because all these people had stories. All these people had histories. And basically, they've been forgotten and invisible.
Well, not just that, but their lives are interrupted by the freeway.
Oh, absolutely.
And what used to be a continuous progress from, as you say, a fabulous taqueria to Cantor's delicatessen,
right.
a continuity of the city, gets interrupted. These characters are segregated into a space where their stories, it's as if their neighborhood becomes a cauldron for the meeting of their stories. And we hear these stories and we hear the interruption, so we are eager to see the character again, but then, like a freeway crossing a neighborhood, another person's story comes along. So when we come to a character we know, it's like at last rejoining an old friend. I wondered what happened to her.
Well, you know, I think of it as you know, a historical event that happened, and the only way to validate that historical event is to take 5 or 6 or 10 different people and sort of give their stories of this particular event. Then it becomes true history for me. It becomes a history of a city. It becomes history of a city that really didn't think so much of us at that point in time. They didn't. I mean, East LA was basically amputated from the rest of the city. And because of that, for better or for worse, we became sort of isolated. I mean, and I grew up with an elementary school, a junior high school, and a high school, all 99.9 Chicano, all of it, you know. And the only time I interacted with Anglos during this period was a policeman who we were petrified of and teachers who we had. But, you know, there was a lot of black teachers. But it just shows you how we were amputated and isolated.
I'm speaking with Helena Maria Viramontes, and you're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. We're in the studios of KCRW. Helena Maria Viramontes is the author most recently of Their Dogs Came With Them, published by Atria. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Helena Maria Viramontes about her novel, The Dogs Came With Them. Now, let's start with the title, because like all great novels, this title really embodies the book when you understand it. Just like Ulysses refers both to the Greece of the Odyssey and to the present-day wanderings of a particular character, this title encompasses history. First of all, on the literal level, this area has been quarantined because it has been said by the city that there is an outbreak of rabies among its dogs.
Right. And, of course, that was, I mean, every time they they do something like that, you know, it's a double-edged sword. They were not at all interested in keeping, you know, the rabies. And I use that. I mean, I had to find a metaphor by which to really, I guess, in case the situation of this particular section of the city, and this was after the Chicano moratorium uprising of 1970, and in fact there were curfews, and in fact we had to go, you know, especially in around the Whittier Boulevard area, we had to go in, we had to show some type of identification in order for them to allow us. I mean, talk about feeling like immigrants in your own land. You know, and so that's what I was thinking about when I was thinking about the quarantine. I also think about the quarantine in terms of keeping people encased because they're somehow contaminated, you know, and you know, that's the way the city treated us.
Well, the basic metaphor here is that the people have to be home at night by a certain time,
right?
Because at night, dogs, which are not chained or otherwise impounded, are being shot at. And so the people are subject to a curfew for their safety while the dogs are being shot.
Right.
On the other hand, these dogs, the presence of the dogs, has a reference to the past,
mm-hmm.
that when the conquistadors came to the New World. Well, why don't you read the epigraph?
I love
fabulous find. Yeah.
I love this epigraph. They came in battle array as conquerors, and the dust rose in whirlwinds on the roads. Their spears glittered in the sun, and their pennants fluttered like bats. They made a loud clamor as they marched, for their coats of mail and their weapons clashed and rattled. Some of them were dressed in glistening iron from head to foot. They terrified everyone who saw them. Their dogs came with them, running ahead of the column. They raised their muzzles high. They lifted their muzzles to the wind. They raced on before with saliva dripping from their jaws.
And that's from?
The Broken Spears, a Aztec account of the Spanish conquest that was translated by Miguel Leon Portillo.
Now, so on the one hand, we have the sense of a conquering race arriving along with its dogs. And now in this novel, the dogs are being shot. We have another race far from conquering who are being enclosed in order to accomplish the extermination of the reportedly diseased dogs. But this, you see, allows the novel to enclose itself. It becomes the structure of the novel, different kinds of enclosures, the freeway, the cemetery, and we get the sense of characters who are, in a sense, forced to reveal their deepest secrets because the trivial secrets have been revealed already. And so the further we go into the book, the deeper we go.
Yes. I think you're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right.
Now, there's something that I read happened during the course of the writing of the book that I find fascinating and I'd like to discuss. Apparently, one of your students at Cornell was the wonderful writer Juno Diaz,
right,
who came along and read some of this book and said, we know some of these characters. These are the cliches of Latino and Latina fiction. And you
right.
suddenly said, you're right and you're wrong,
right,
but I'm going to accept that you're right.
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote the book again to break cliches. And
right.
I would say there are none of these characters here who I already know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that all of these characters are fresh. They are not illustrations in the ongoing literature of victimization. They are fresh and original characters who I have not seen before.
Thank you.
But talk about how these characters changed in the wake of having that rather blinding revelation from a student. No, you can't present these characters.
Well, Juno was very actually he was a bit cautious. I say the word cautious in giving me his critique because he was finishing his MFA, of course, and you know he was just a budding writer at that time, had not published Drown yet, and here he was, you know, telling you know. I guess he was just nerve-wracked at the fact that I had asked him and respected him that much because I did, and I continue to do so. And he did. I mean, he looked at it, and he did give me some real good thought, you know, fruit for thought. When he told me, he said, you know, this figure, Turtle, I mean, we see it all over the place. We see him all over the place. He's just not – he's a cliché that you're pushing, you know. And oh boy, when he said that, I mean, my heart dropped because, of course, I don't think of any of these people as cliches. And I went home, but I really thought about it because I do respect him, and I do respect him. And you know, I was thinking, well, okay, I cannot just drop this character who I feel, I mean, is so fascinating to me because of the fact that you know other people have seen him, you know, around. But I did think, what kind of new revelation can I have for this person? Or not even that. That's a bad word. What kind of angle can I see this person's life? And so what I did is I actually went back home. I go back to East LA and I walk. My brother Frank and I walk the streets at time. He's my great companion. Or else I drive by the streets. And then, boom, I remember about this woman who, in fact, at that point when I was growing up, we didn't have a word for it, but now I would presume she would be called a butch dyke or a dyke butch. She was a young woman who, in fact, killed her father, her father who was the neighborhood drunk. And I always remember that story because I remember the father. I remember the father used to come over to my mother's house or my aunt's house and sweep the driveways or do little pickup work, and then they would give him a meal in exchange for that. And so I remember that. I remember that the chalk at the dead end where he was murdered, and I never, except for that one time, I had never seen her before. But then I just thought, holy moly, this is it. This is her story. This is it. And from one end to the other, I just changed the gender, and I thought about her, and I thought about her sadness with her father, and that just opened the doors.
Well, in fact, you see, we've, in a sense, seen her out of the corner of her eyes from time to time, a woman who is very closed in on herself, very tough and very recalcitrant, mm-hmm. who has disguised herself in the clothing not just of a male, but of a gang male, of a cholo. And even her fellow gang members, especially her brother, they know that she's not going to be able to sustain a terrible battle because people are going to, if she's disrobed, discover her breasts. And they don't treat her the way they do the other brothers, so that her silence and her fierceness and her aggression is unimaginable. But the book imagines it and goes inside the gender extravagance, recreation of this woman. But at the same time, what we're also told is, don't think that this is the story that is told only of the extraordinary. The extraordinary, the book says, is a misrepresentation. There's a young man, Ben, who is a strange kind of genius. He's had a terrible childhood accident, and he's capable of memorizing anatomy books, and he's the one in the neighborhood who gets a scholarship to USC, and his memory is phenomenal. And yet the book tells us, even as it's telling us his extraordinary story, that the one who is extraordinary is his sister, the ordinary one, who has been called upon to sacrifice her life just because we like to tell the story of the extraordinary, or the stereotype. While the ordinary stays in the shadow. And it's exploring the shadow of the ordinary that this book excels at.
Oh, Michael, thank you. I mean, you've given me chills. During the time that I was writing, you know, this or just exploring the Ben character is, you know, just seeing in the background, Anna, who has to be responsible. And to a certain extent, I mean, in my extended family, we've always been like that. We've always had really incredible odds in terms of people who've been very ill. And I mean, within this last year, I've had my father died last May. My sister died in August. My brother died in February, and my uncle died just last week. And each time, my family has to rise to the occasion in helping with the passing, the funeral, and even before that, in the illnesses, to be there and to take care. This is why I think I'm so committed to honoring people like Anna. I mean, characters like Anna, who day by day simply, you know, they sacrifice a great amount of their lives because they've been given this. They've been given this, and they can choose not to deal with family. They can choose not to deal with caring, but in fact do. And Anna is an incredible hero to me. Here she is. All she wants to do is try to take care of her. And, you know, she's not a saint. I mean, you know, she understands this is a pain. You know, she gets frustrated and everything else. But here she is. She will do what she can to take care of him.
I've been talking with Elena Maria Viramontes, author most recently of Their Dogs Came With Them, published by Atria. But before we say goodbye, I wanted to say, you know, there are certain books, and I'm a pretty good judge of this, that are going to become over time the books of their time. Some of them we've been lucky enough to have had on Bookworm immediately when they've been published. This is one of them. With the world as it is now, it will take the 8 or 9 years that it takes a great book to get discovered and to build an audience. But I have a confidence that this is one of those books. And I hope if you're listening, you'll have the curiosity to find this book, which is from a relatively new press, and read it right away. Their Dogs Came With Them by Elena Maria Viramontes. Thank you, Elena, for joining me.
Michael, thank you very much.
You can read an excerpt from Their Dogs Came With Them at kcrw.com/bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.